Hello again, Steve McKinlay. Dr. Steve McKinlay here with the podcast for utilitarianism, which is the topic we are studying this week. And this is podcast number 2. And in this particular podcast, I want to discuss in a little bit more detail utilitarianism. I want to look at the concept of impartiality, which becomes very important in all of the ethical theories. So I'll explain that. And then I want to look at two different versions of utilitarianism: act utilitarianism and rule utilitarianism. We'll go through those two topics. And then I want to look at some of the criticisms or objections. So people that oppose utilitarianism, some of the arguments they come up with as to why it's not a good ethical theory. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about ethical dilemmas. And what constitutes an ethical dilemma, and how ethical dilemmas differ from just ethical issues which we are usually able to resolve with some logical argument and some rational thought. So, utilitarianism. Now, one of the things that I want to make important at this point, and it's often a trap that people first studying ethics fall into. A couple of points, really. First of all, you may recall in the previous podcast, I said that utilitarianism really has to apply to the collective, so the majority of people. So what we're trying to do is maximize the good for the majority of the people. We're not trying to maximize our own good. Often trying to, if we were to maximize our own good, it may be at the detriment of other people. So you've got to keep that in mind to begin with. The next important point to make is that utilitarianism needs to be, a utilitarian judgment needs to be applied in comparison to the good and bad consequences of some other alternative action, right? So it's not about maximizing the good out of a particular decision. It's about maximizing the good based on a variety of different alternative decisions that you could have made, right? So the issue is whether the amount of good an action will produce is larger or smaller compared to that of alternative actions. So that's actually very important to remember. And that will be important to remember in your first assignment, particularly if you choose to use utilitarianism as one of your methods for assessing an ethical problem. Right, so the comparison is the likely net of the good and bad consequences of one action versus the likely net good and bad consequences of another action. So please keep that in mind. The next little topic that comes up, which is a bit of a sideline topic, I'm looking currently at page 16 of the PowerPoint presentations, Meta-Ethical Theories number 1. And this is called the acts omissions doctrine. So this is a little sideline angle. It's not, I wouldn't call it a version of utilitarianism. It's just a particular issue that comes up with utilitarianism. And it's usually an application to medical ethics. So let me try and explain what acts and omissions doctrine is. So many consequentialist theories hold that a deliberate action is actually no different from a deliberate decision not to act. So you can make, so one of the options of your alternative options that where an action is going to be a consequence is not to do anything at all, right? So your decision to do nothing at all, or not make a decision, or not do anything at all, has consequences itself and is also considered by most ethicists a moral decision in itself. So that's an interesting little line. So how this comes about in application to medical ethics is that there can be a significant moral distinction between acts that you have deliberately chosen to do. So let's say in medical ethics where you make the decision to perform a medical procedure on someone or provide someone with some kind of medical assistance, and then deliberate non-actions, which incidentally may end up leading to the exact same outcome. So deliberate non-actions, which could lead to the same outcome. I'm wondering if you can think of any any situations in medical ethics. Let me give you one. When people come to towards the end of their life, decisions, often medical decisions, have to be made with regard to what level of treatment are we going to give that person. So in palliative care, for example, we would give treatment to alleviate any pain that a person had when they were coming to the end of their life. Now, when we're talking about this, we're usually thinking about somebody who is essentially dying. So it's somebody who's not, has no real chance of making any kind of recovery. They may have terminal cancer, for example, or they may just be very, very old and their body is just giving up, their organs are starting to shut down. So quite often in medical ethics, decisions are made at the end of life to actually do nothing, to just provide pain relief for the person, but not to intervene from a medical perspective to prolong a person's life, because they're going to die anyway. Usually those decisions are made in conjunction with the patient's family and so on, right? So a doctor obviously should never kill a patient, right? But most people within the medical profession also believe it's morally permissible to let a patient die under certain circumstances. And there are very good utilitarian arguments that can be used to justify, morally justify that decision, right? And there's a little paper, which is only about 3 pages long on the Moodle page, called The Acts and Omissions Doctrine, which you might like to have a look at, which outlines a utilitarian argument for that position. The concept of impartiality. Now, this is a new term, which I don't think I've really discussed too much at this point, but it's a very important concept in ethical theory. So the idea of impartiality means that all ethical theories require that we consider every individual in an impartial way. So Peter Singer calls this the equal consideration of all interests. So that means we don't take preference for a particular group in society. So we should apply ethical decisions equally to every individual in society, regardless of whether they're a famous sports person or a celebrity, or they're rich, or they're a particular colour, or they come from a particular country, and so on. Impartiality tells us that we should treat everybody equally, right? So utilitarianism requires us to maximise happiness, considering equally the happiness of all people affected by it, no matter who those people are, right? Another concept that's worth just talking about before we start looking at some objections to utilitarianism, and we look at the difference between act and rule utilitarianism, is the idea of harm minimization. So utilitarianism requires us to maximize happiness and minimize harm or evil, and an action is the best action, and an action is not necessarily the best action if it merely produces more good than harm. It must be likely to produce more good and less harm than all the alternatives. So I know I've stated that before, but I just wanted to reiterate that. Okay, now we come to a variation on utilitarianism, which is called act utilitarianism. I'm looking at page 19 of the PowerPoint slides, if you've got the PowerPoint slides in front of you or you want to watch them. You don't necessarily have to go through the PowerPoint slides at the same time, but I'm just indicating where I am in the slides if you did want to follow along. So act utilitarianism focuses on the action to be weighed up against other possible alternative actions in order to decide which action is morally acceptable, right? So that's what act utilitarianism means. What action should we choose? It also states that rules should not be treated more than anything as guides, and they should not substitute as assessing each of the available actions, right? So it holds actions as preferential, or to take precedence over rules. Actions become the most important thing. So let me try and give this an example. Let's consider the example of lying, right? So we all know that as a general rule, we shouldn't lie, right? Our parents teach us this as we grow up, and we know that it's important to tell the truth. It's just a general rule of thumb that we use in our life. But there are times when the act of lying could be considered acceptable, right? So the thought experiment that's used in utilitarian arguments is, imagine if a killer, a murderer comes to the door and asks you if a particular person is in the house, and that person is in the house and you know they're upstairs, and the murderer wants to kill that person, but you have the option of saying, no, they're not here. So you would be lying in order to save somebody's life, right? So that's, I know it's a pretty hypothetical situation, but it is one that's considered to be an example of where we can sometimes bend the rules or break the rules if the action has a more morally acceptable outcome, right? So therefore, act utilitarianism seems to provide an objectively true results, because we know that it's objectively true, for example, that if someone lives rather than dies due to an ethical decision, we've probably made the right decision, right? So let's look at some objections to act utilitarianism. The first one that's discussed on page 20 of the slides is called the wrong answers objection, right? Wrong answers. So that means that if we apply act utilitarianism, sometimes we can come up with the wrong answers or something that doesn't make sense. So the example given in the slides is, if a doctor can save 5 people from death by killing one healthy person, and we can use that healthy person's organs to do life-saving transplants into the other people, then act utilitarianism seems to imply that the doctor should kill the one healthy person to save the 5 other people, because we're maximizing the pleasure or happiness of those people, and we're minimizing the harm. We don't want 5 people to die. We want 5 people to live if only one person is going to die, right? Well, this seems obviously on the face of it just wrong, right? And that's why we call it the wrong answers. The other example is, for example, if a person makes a promise, but by breaking the promise, that allows that person to perform an action that creates slightly more overall well-being than keeping the promise, then it seems to follow that act utilitarianism means that we should break the promise, right? So sometimes this comes up as being the wrong answers objection too. And the next objection that's listed is called undermining trust, right? So, and it seems to follow on from the wrong answers objection. So in the cases that we've just discussed, such as doctors and people making promises, if those people make decisions that benefit others or break promises, or more generally, everyone believes that morality permitting lying or breaking promises when that leads to good results, then it kind of follows that no one would trust others not to break the rules, right? So if there was a chance that you went to the doctor and the doctor said, sorry, we're going to have to kill you so that we can take your organs for 5 people who need your organ transplants, then that would undermine your trust in doctors, right? You wouldn't want to go to a doctor. So that's where the undermining trust objection comes from. There's another famous objection to utilitarianism, which is to do with the impartiality requirement, right? So remember that utilitarianism requires us to be impartial and treat everyone equally. And sometimes this is called the too demanding or special obligations objection. It seems to be too demanding that we treat everyone equally, in particular when a member of our family is one of the people that could be the result of an action decision that you make, right? So imagine that several children are swept out to sea by a rogue wave, and one of those children is your child, your young daughter or son. Well, it seems obvious that we would hold our nearest and dearest with higher regard and with regard to making moral decisions, right? So you're more likely to go and save your own child, and nobody would judge you on that, right? Everyone agrees that this is a rational, normal thing to do. So the impartiality requirement often is seen as being too demanding, right? Another argument that Peter Singer makes in the little video, actually, which is on the Moodle page, is that Peter Singer argues that we potentially should not buy luxury items when there are people living in poverty. But once again, you know, he provides a utilitarian argument for that position. But once again, we can see that that seems to be too demanding, you know. I recently bought myself a nice car. I'd had a pretty old rubbish car for many, many years, and I decided to buy a nice car. And while it's not a super expensive car, I do consider it to be quite a luxury for me to buy a car that's probably the most expensive car I've ever bought in my life. But when you get to my age, you can justify these kinds of decisions, right? But Peter Singer would probably say, hey, Steve, you've spent a lot of money on a car when you didn't really need to. You could have bought a really cheap car and then given your money to charity, right? Okay, so the critics argue that these particular criticisms prove that ACT utilitarianism could potentially be wrong, right? It fails to recognize the moral legitimacy of acting for the benefit of our loved ones. And it seems to forbid that we act on, which seems to forbid that we act on behalf of ourselves and to consider strangers or people living in poverty. And this seems to be more than can be reasonably expected of most people, right? Okay, so that's a summary of ACT utilitarianism. Now let's look at the opposite to ACT utilitarianism, or well, not so much the opposite, but a variation, which is called rule utilitarianism. And obviously rule utilitarianism is where we put the precedence on the rules. So what are the rules? So what are the moral rules? I'm sure you can think of many moral rules, right? A moral rule, a classic moral and ethical rule is we shouldn't lie, right? Another set of rules, which is good to be used as an example, is the road rules, right? So in New Zealand and in almost every country in the world, you're not allowed to drink alcohol and drive. You're not allowed to speed. You're meant to stop at red lights and so on and so forth, right? But if we followed ACT utilitarianism, we could justify to ourselves in order to maximise the overall happiness, it's okay if I speed on this particular situation and so on and so forth, right? But having road rules that limit a driver's discretionary judgments seems to decrease the danger to other people, and so therefore you could argue that the road rules are, from a utilitarian perspective, maximise the happiness for the majority of people, because the rules are in place so that people we can avoid harm, right? Rule utilitarianism in some cases avoids the criticisms of ACT utilitarianism. And so as long as we follow the rules, we can generally be assured to maximise happiness. So here's an example. I'm looking at page 23 on the slides, the PowerPoint slides, and there's two options here. So one option is it goes back to the doctor killing the patients again for organ transplants. So rule A, that allows a medical doctor to kill healthy patients so he can use organs for transplants and save a larger number of people. Or rule B, that forbids doctors to remove the organs of healthy patients in order to benefit other patients. So we can see that if we adopt rule A, which allows doctors to kill healthy patients for more organ transplants, then the result would be that not many people would want to go to doctors anymore for fear of being killed, right? So we can see there that rule utilitarianism avoids that thought experiment that we talked about before. There are some objections to rule utilitarianism as well. The first one is called rule worship. So this is an irrational deference to the rules that doesn't make any sense or doesn't have any utilitarian justification. So we have to be wary of that one. And then there is the problem where rule utilitarianism potentially can collapse into ACT utilitarianism. What this means is that in certain interpretations of certain rules means that actually we're not doing rule utilitarianism anymore, we're just doing ACT utilitarianism. Right, so if we consider the rule that it's always wrong to lie, except when a person's life is at stake. So if you think of the Terminator movie where Sarah Connor is trying to be murdered by the Terminator, I'm not sure if everyone's seen that movie, but if you haven't, just ignore it. So just imagine the rule We shouldn't lie, but somebody comes to the door and asks if Sarah Connor is in the house, and Sarah Connor is in the house, but you lie so that you can save Sarah Connor's life, then that means that we've changed the whole rules around, right? So it means that the rule might say something like, do X except when not doing X maximizes utility. And maybe do not do X except when doing X maximizes utility. So if we apply these rules, well, then we're just doing the same thing as ACT utilitarianism, right? So another example is we should follow the rules, but you can speed in your car if you're rushing someone to hospital, right? So, pardon me, in that particular case, we're back to ACT utilitarianism, right? The next objection, some other general objections to utilitarianism, a couple here. First one is, how do we quantify utility? So I sort of mentioned this earlier in the first podcast. It's the problem of measuring what's good. So as we discussed earlier, personal preference seems to be important in the absence of any objective method of assessing what is good. So this is the problem called quantifying utility. How do we know what decision we make is going to maximize utility? Is that utility or utilitarianism sometimes doesn't seem to consider justice, the concept of justice. So even though Bentham denied this, many critics claim that utilitarianism would permit the punishment of an innocent person if it was for the greater good. And there's an interesting thought experiment from a novel called The Brothers Karamazov by an author, a Russian author called Fyodor Dostoevsky. Not sure if any of you have read that novel. But in the novel, there is this is the example. I'll read it out and then I'll try and explain it a little bit more. This is a quote. Imagine that you yourself are building the edifice of human destiny with the object of making everyone completely happy as the grand finale, of giving everybody peace and rest at last. But for that, you must inevitably and unavoidably torture a young child. So the idea here is that, you know, imagine that we could build this perfect utopian world where everyone is happy. But in order to have that, you have to torture and murder a young child. So, I mean, obviously this is a hypothetical thought experiment, but it's an interesting one that ends up being an objection to utilitarianism. A couple of other points, looking at page 26, and one of the more recent criticisms of utilitarianism is the problem of baby farming. So this is interesting. You really need to read the slide to understand this in a bit more detail, but I'll explain it to you. So an ethicist in the mid-1990s wrote a paper and argued that utilitarianism lacks the conceptual apparatus to comprehend the concept of innocence, a feature central to all other ethical theories. So the example that Jacqueline and Lang gives is a pure utilitarian, without contradicting themselves, could not reasonably reject the idea of baby farming. So that is that we mass produce deliberately brain-damaged children in order to raise them to grow for the purpose of organ harvesting. So the old organ harvesting issue again. So that's an interesting objection as well. And then next week we're going to look at Kantian ethics, which is a duty-based ethics, and utilitarianism often goes head-to-head with duty-based objections. So most of the Kantian ethicists would argue utilitarianism falls down because it fails to consider our duties and our obligations. So look, there are quite a few other objections and there are quite a few other variations to utilitarianism, but we've covered the basics and I think that's pretty good for this course. There is one more conclusion that I guess that utilitarian comes to that I'll just briefly go over. So I'm looking at page 27 of the PowerPoint slides. Now, a famous philosopher called Derek Parfit, who I think only died last year, actually, or the year before, perhaps, very famous modern philosopher, and he argued that the consideration of total happiness falls victim to what's called the repugnant conclusion. So the repugnant conclusion is this idea whereby large numbers of people with very low but non-negative utility values. So let's say a whole lot of a very, very large population of people living pretty miserably, not all that happy. He argues that that actually creates more utility than a small population that has a very high level of average well-being and average happiness. So if you look at the diagram on page 27 of the slides, you'll see how this kind of pans out. And Derek Parfit argued that that was the repugnant conclusion. Okay, the very last thing that I want to talk about in this podcast, and then we'll wrap it up, is this concept, the idea of ethical dilemmas. Now, I know a lot of you will have heard of ethical dilemmas. It's used in the media a lot, you know, and everything seems to be, every ethical issue in the popular media seems to be an ethical dilemma. Well, this is not really quite correct, and it's sort of one of the reasons I want to discuss it here is because it kind of irritates me a little bit how the media calls everything an ethical dilemma. And I'm hoping that you, when you're writing your essays, don't use the term ethical dilemma unless you really are talking about an ethical dilemma. So, what is an ethical dilemma? Well, by definition, an ethical dilemma is an unsolvable ethical problem, right? So there is no satisfactory resolution. Sometimes they're called ethical paradoxes, and usually it involves a decision-making problem, an ethical decision-making problem, where there are two or more moral outcomes, which are both of them would be morally clearly morally unacceptable, right? So imagine that, and here's the example that I give is captured in a paper which I've always also put on the Moodle page as well, called Sophie's Choice. I think it's called Sophie's Choice, Sophie's something, Sophie's World, or Sophie's Choice. And in this particular paper, it discusses a scenario in Nazi Germany during the Second World War where a mother and her two children are marched into a concentration camp. And as they approach the concentration camp, one of the guards says to the mother, "You have to tell me which child I'm going to shoot and kill. And if you choose not to make that decision, I'm going to shoot and kill both of them." Right, so that truly is an ethical dilemma, right? And so ethical dilemmas, by their pure nature, usually result in pretty horrible kinds of outcomes. So have a think about what kinds of things might constitute an ethical dilemma. Now, on the very last slide, I give the classic ethical problem that's discussed to new students studying ethics about ethical dilemmas. And this it's called the trolley problem. So if you were to do a Google search on the trolley problem, you'll find loads and loads and loads and loads of articles and discussions about it. And it can relate to ethical implications for autonomous vehicles. So it's quite important for us to consider it. And the trolley problem goes like this. So you imagine a train that's running along on train tracks, called a trolley, right, running on train tracks. And you're at a junction of the train tracks and you have the ability to do nothing, which is an ethical decision, as we've already said, or you have the ability to throw a switch and change the direction of the trolley going down tracks. So it switches and goes down another track. On one, the trolley is going to run and kill five workers working on the track if you do nothing. But if you hit the switch, it'll switch tracks and go down another path and then potentially knock over a mum pushing a pram with her baby in it. So the decision to make is, do we save the five or six workers working on the track, or do we potentially sacrifice the baby that's in the pram on the railway tracks? And that's called a trolley problem, and that's where I'm going to leave it today for you to think about. And that pretty much wraps the material up for today. So what I'd like everyone to do is have a read of some of the material on the Moodle page. Please have a watch of the Peter Singer video. It's only short. I think it's about 6 or 7 minutes. Have a look at the summary of utilitarianism YouTube clip as well. That's very interesting. It's also very short. And then have a go at the quiz and unlock the revision and reflection questions for utilitarianism. I hope you enjoyed these podcasts, and I'll talk to you again soon.